The year is 1937. Mussolini's fascist regime imprisoned thousands of Italian citizens whose views were considered anti-government. Among them was a 23-year-old University of Florence law student and communist, Ernest van den Haag. Born in Holland and raised in Italy, the young van den Haag was held in solitary confinement for 18 months in Naples. When released, he had reason to believe that his re-imprisonment would be imminent and fled to France, where he studied psychiatry at the Sorbonne, and eventually made his way to the United States in 1940. Working as a busboy and vegetable seller in New York, he was able to secure admission to the State University of Iowa, where he received his Master's of Arts degree. Returning to New York as a lecturer in psychology and sociology, Ernest van den Haag received his Ph.D. from New York University in 1952. His political philosophy was changing rapidly. In 1942, Ernest had met Sidney Hook, the social philosopher who served as a catalyst in van den Haag's thinking. Ernest van den Haag was becoming less secure in his communist beliefs. Ultimately, the one-time communist evolved into one of the most respected voices of the conservative intellectual movement in the United States and an outspoken anti-communist. He published a number of works, including The Fabric of Society in 1957, The Jewish Mystique in 1969, and Political Violence and Civil Disobedience in 1972. In 1975, he published Punishing Criminals, concerning a very old and painful question, which established van den Haag as one of the leading voices in American criminology and led to his appointment as visiting professor of criminal justice at the State University of New York in Albany, and later as the John M. Olin Professor of Jurisprudence and Public Policy at Fordham University. He has been a longtime member of the Mont Pelerin Society, past president of the Philadelphia Society, and a distinguished scholar at the Heritage Foundation. Today, Professor van den Haag continues to pursue his interests in criminal law and criminology as part of his broader study of the nature of a free society. He continues to write, recently publishing an article entitled The Hostility of Intellectuals to Capitalism. Ernest van den Haag has devoted his life to analyzing many of the complex questions facing modern society and formulating observations that have been widely regarded both for their insight and clarity. Liberty Fund welcomes you to a conversation with Ernest van den Haag. You had some somewhat exceptional experiences in Italy. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I was put in prison because at the time I was a communist. So they were probably right of putting me in prison. But anyway, I spent nearly 2 years in solitary confinement, which is probably what makes me look vicious now. But nothing really happened to me, although this threat was constantly hanging over me. Then I was released and used this, knowing full well that they were just trying to find out what I was doing. I fled, went to Switzerland, from Switzerland to France, and I spent some time in France. And then the French put me into a concentration camp because they decided I was an enemy alien. Italian, and I did not object to that because the alternative would have been to be in a concentration camp as a communist. I wouldn't like that any better. I fled from the French concentration camp as France collapsed and went over to Spain and finally Portugal. I fled in a very romantic way, jumping on a truck and people shooting after me, etc. And I must say, I always felt miscast because my interest was then, as it is now, in philosophy, in ideas, and not in adventures. But anyway, I was compelled to be adventurous, and I was. I saved my life by all kinds of devices. Ended up in Portugal and then came to the United States.
Now, during this time, you say you called yourself a communist. How did this come about? Were you just a youthful idealist, or was it a...
You're entirely right. I was a useful fool. I didn't realize that the communists were at least as bad as the fascists, in some ways worse, because they were more systematic. And they went in Italy. Italians are basically humanists. I remember I was in Naples in prison, and they would take me out every so often to question me, and I was put in a big cage, sort of, where they kept the people arrested during the day. And I remember I was in that cage, and some two carabinieri policemen approached me from outside and said, "What are you doing in here, sir?" So I didn't look like a criminal, I guess. I said, "Well, I'm suspected of having the wrong ideas." I was very careful, of course. Stuck back, saluted, and said, "We respect other people's ideas." That was after many years of fascism, so it hadn't penetrated.
Now, how did it come about that you eventually did become an intellectual, a full-time intellectual, in fact?
I was born an intellectual.
I see.
I never had any other ambitions or so. I stopped being a communist when I came to this country and met Sidney Hook, who became a friend, and others, A.P. Lerner. And Sidney converted me. I became, not only stopped being a communist and became an anti-communist, which I am to this day, although this no longer means much. I also stopped being a Marxist. Sidney still liked to call himself a socialist, but I don't think he was a socialist, and I certainly am not. I'm now as much a free market, or almost a libertarian, but not quite.
Which gets me to ask you, you're a multidisciplinarian. You started in what discipline, and then how did you gravitate to some of the other ones?
In Italy, I studied law, which is not every, so to speak, well-born Italian needs a title. Mine was avocado, but I didn't practice law, and I didn't really finish my studies either. When I came to this country, I decided to study economics, and I got a PhD in economics, but I got sort of bored with economics and taught what we probably called sociology, political philosophy, etc.
How was it possible for you to get a degree in economics and yet gravitate into these other fields?
I wrote books, and I became professor of jurisprudence and public policy at Fordham, largely on the strength of a book called Punishing Criminals, which I published and which apparently was thought of highly. So I became the only professor of law who had never studied law, at least not in this country.
You know, in that connection, of course, you're very well known as a powerful tenacious advocate of the death penalty for serious crimes. And tell us a little bit about your way of coming at that position.
Well, I have been, I changed my position as I have grown older. I've become mellow. I no longer am in favor of the death penalty for parking violations or anything like that.
Mellowing.
Yes, but I still am in favor of the death penalty for murder. And I don't remember how I got into that issue. I think I probably didn't like some of the arguments of abolitionists and started to work on the topic. And I remained an advocate of the death penalty, and I think for basically two reasons. When it is deserved, and I have a fairly Kantian position on this. And I also think it's useful, but let me make it clear that I don't think it should be used because it may be useful. I don't think you can execute a person because it may discourage others or any such mm-hmm. purpose. You can only execute a person because you're convinced that he deserves this punishment. That is really true for all punishments. They must be deserved. You don't punish people because it's useful. You punish them because they have done things that deserve punishment. And there are some things that, in my opinion, deserve the death penalty.
So you are, in that respect, a retributionist.
I am.
Do you think that there is a rational justification for these moral notions, or are you more in the school of intuitionists or even someone who believes that maybe this is a matter of convention?
We can reason about these things. But what we reason about ultimately is our intuition, our feeling. We do feel that certain acts require greater punishment than other acts. If you're asking me why we feel so, in the end, I just will end up saying that's what we feel.
What do you say to those who maintain that with respect to the death penalty, there is a problem of its being irrevocable, and that we should try to prevent that out of prudence, not because any criminal deserves it, but because we should not sully our hands, so to speak, with such a dangerous and risky activity?
Well, it's not a very good argument, I think, because most abolitionists advocate the abolishing the death penalty even for people who are guilty. In other words, they don't argue that innocence should be spared. I'm not in favor of the death penalty for innocence either. They argue that the guilty should also be spared. One reason being is that they feel errors will occur and some of the people thought to be guilty may turn out to be innocent.
The argument that I was trying to put forth, right?
Well, that is true for all punishments, of course. Probably less true for the death penalty because people tend to be more careful. But it undoubtedly is statistically true that over the long run, since courts are human, they will make mistakes, there will be miscarriages of justice. But you see, many innocent people die for all kinds of reasons. The death penalty is not exactly introducing deaths that could have been avoided. In the words of John Stuart Mill, it hastens death. Mm-hmm. It doesn't introduce it. And it probably shortens the life of the people who are subjected to it. Now, the next question is, should we do that? Should we shorten their life? Well, they have done it to others. The death penalty is not given except for premeditated mm-hmm. murder, usually murder under very bad circumstances. And it seems to me that people volunteer for the death penalty, for the risk of the death penalty, not for the penalty itself. But they do think, they do undertake actions that risk the death penalty. They run this risk deliberately. If it isn't deliberate, they won't get the death penalty. Now, it seems to me that since they volunteer for this risk, they have no reason, no good reason, to complain when that which they risk actually does occur.
I see.
Now, to come back to a point you made before, it is true statistically that in the long run, some people will get the death penalty who do not deserve it because they are not guilty. But let me make a distinction here. Recently, I saw on TV a parade of about 75 persons who claimed that they were sentenced to death and then found innocent and thus escaped execution. Now, our courts don't find anyone innocent. They decide merely whether there is proof beyond a reasonable doubt of their guilt or there isn't. When they decide there isn't, it doesn't mean that they have proof of the innocence. They have many failure to prove that they're guilty. Most of these 75 persons were not shown to be innocent, but rather what was shown is that in sentencing them to death, some procedural error was committed. In some way, the proof was not sufficient. I think that it is possible that people who are actually innocent will be sentenced to death, but it occurs very rarely, particularly when appeals are made, etc., etc. I do think that some acts are so terrible, so heinous, that I do not want to live with the people who committed them in a community. I think they should be expelled from the human community by being executed.
Now, you don't actually worry too much about the fact that sometimes it is claimed, and sometimes claimed with some measure of credibility, that the death penalty is applied rather discriminately in a society.
Yeah, that seems to me a very irrelevant argument. Let me put it this way. A guilty murderer does not become less guilty because he is black and has been sentenced to death, and an equally guilty white person has not been sentenced to death and is not being executed. His guilt is not diminished because someone else, equally guilty, did not suffer the punishment he should have been given. Both should be clearly punished. But generally speaking, I'll have to put this in more general form. No criminal can say, I should not be punished because X, another criminal, as guilty, did not suffer punishment. If he accepted that reasoning, we couldn't punish anybody because most criminals are not caught, and if caught, are not proven guilty and are not punished. We have to catch and punish those we can get, and the others just will escape.
I want to go to a point that I think you have a special interest in, namely the difference between approaches to criminal behavior. Some are therapeutic approaches, some are punishment or punitive approaches. The famous American defense lawyer Clarence Darrow used to argue that there really are no criminals because we all just do what we were determined to do in life. What do you say about this approach? Do you think the two can be reconciled, or must one be true and the other false?
That idea is not really new, but on the contrary, it's on the decline now. Fortunately, we have turned to punishing criminals instead of attempting to reform them. Not enough, I think, but anyway, the opposition between these two, punishment versus treatment, is nonsensical. Treatment could not be successful unless there is punishment. Let me put it very simply. If a criminal is sent to me, and some people say, well, you ought to reform him, and I suggest to him that he's foolish to commit his crimes because it's irrational, doesn't further his own interests, etc. He points out correctly, if there is no punishment, that all he suffers is to see me. And that's not so much of a punishment.
Not very grave punishment.
No, I think any attempt of reforming, and none of them have been very successful, can only be made if backed by sanctions. I must be able to tell the criminal that what he does is not in his own interest. Look, you are in prison. You are suffering. You don't like it. Now, I can tell you the best way to avoid that, perhaps. It hasn't worked, but I mean, that at least makes some sense. But it hasn't worked for a variety of reasons. Reforming criminals is not helpful. Most of them cannot be reformed. Those who are reformed are not really reformed due to the activities of the reformers. Some get older and less interested in the risk, etc., of crimes. Some have committed crimes which themselves reform them. You kill your wife, say, well, you may no longer be interested in committing any other crimes. You just wanted to kill that particular wife who was a nuisance. And for that matter, it could be said that anyone else who had married that wife would have killed her too. It wasn't you who was particularly criminally inclined. It was the provocation which was too strong for most people in this case. But at any rate, I don't believe in reform at all. I believe that some people can be deterred by the fear of punishment, and that's about the best thing we have. Now, there are circumstances that induce crime, including, for instance, drugs and other things. Drugs in many ways. There's a great deal of profit to be made by selling them, and that is a crime. And also the drugs themselves may be criminogenic. But to come back to treatment, it cannot be opposed to punishment. It's punishment is part of the treatment and a very important part. I think people who feel there is this opposition, treatment on the one hand, punishment on the other, fail to see. For instance, I'll give you a very fashionable instance. Many particularly violent criminals have suffered all kinds of difficulties when they were younger. They were mistreated by their parents, perhaps sexually abused, whatever the case may be. Now, that is true for many criminals, but people forget to notice that other people never became criminals having been subjected to the same treatment. So it can't be the only thing. And one must not confuse an explanation, of which mistreatment can be a part, with a justification. The fact that you were mistreated as a young boy, say, does not excuse your present murder. It may contribute to explaining why you got interested in murder or robbery or so, but it doesn't exonerate you. It doesn't mean that you had, so to speak, a right because you were mistreated. Criminals are not sick people. They're criminals.
But you said that said that in the current era there is a return to applying punishment to criminals.
Yes.
On the other hand, in the social sciences, people like Edward Wilson and so on, who are evolutionary biologists or in some other sense social biological scientists, are more and more inclined to explain all facets of human behavior by reference to genes, by reference to some physiological mechanism.
The fact that you can say that people who act in a certain way have certain genes that lead them to act in this way may be quite true, just as it may be true that they were treated in a certain way in childhood that may lead them to act that way. But it doesn't mean that they couldn't help acting this way, and that they are not responsible for their actions. You know, a crime is defined as an action that you voluntarily undertake. And I think it is voluntary. It makes some, in some circumstances, it's more likely than in others, but it's still a voluntary act. It's not a compelled act. You could have acted differently. And that is as true when you speak of genes as when you speak of social circumstances.
Do you think that the conviction that people are responsible for their own behavior and thus may be punished when they misbehave is a universal idea, or is it mostly just in certain cultures?
No, I think it's quite universal ideas. In fact, in many cultures, people feel that even if you were not, cannot be shown to have directly done whatever is charged, you still are guilty. You are guilty whenever you do something that you could have avoided and that you knew was wrong.
But in some places...
But forgive me for a moment, okay. I'll just continue. And let me point out, this belief in determination, which is applied to criminals, for some reason is not applied to their judges or the jury. I mean, after all, if you know how the old joke goes, the criminal saying to the judge, well, I'm not responsible for what I did because in my childhood, look at this, that, and the other, therefore you should not punish me. To which the judge, in the joke, replies, well, in my childhood, X, Y, and Z, and therefore I'm not responsible for sentencing you to 10 years.
That's right.
That's it. If the criminals are not responsible, why should other people be responsible?
There is, however, a claim to the effect that it requires more of an individualist social philosophy to apply this idea of personal responsibility and punishment, which many, many societies lack because of their greater concentration on groups and tribes and clans.
I don't find this to be the case. I mean, it makes perfect sense, but I think individual punishment prevails in all societies I know of. Sometimes the whole group is held responsible, too, but the individual, the culpable individual certainly is always included, and the notion that you are responsible for your actions and deserve punishment is quite universal, I think.
Sticking to law, you also have a fairly distinctive view on civil disobedience. You have written a book on it. You have engaged in a debate with Jeffrey Riemann on the subject and with some others. What is your view of civil disobedience?
Well, it's a long story, but let me put it this way. I distinguish between conscientious objection and civil disobedience. Conscientious objectors merely say they cannot, for conscientious reasons, do what the law requires them to do, in some cases military service, etc. And I can understand that, and within limits, I would really support that. Now, civil disobedience goes a little further. It asks people who oppose a law for good reasons, they think, to actually obstruct that law. And that, I think, is very difficult to defend in a country that believes in obedience to law. Now, some laws undoubtedly are not just in some way, but nonetheless, the way to oppose these laws in a democracy is to try to persuade one's fellow citizens to abrogate these laws. So I am not in favor of civil disobedience, so I can live with conscientious objection.
Well, proponents of civil disobedience often say that civil disobedience is itself a means of challenging a law, and as long as you stay around to be arrested and tried, you are doing the right thing because you're playing within the rules. You're just utilizing the procedure to test whether this law ultimately is just.
You're not playing within the rules. The rules are that you, as a citizen, you have to obey the law. You refuse to do that. It's true that you accept your punishment, but accepting your punishment doesn't justify the act that is being punished. In other words, if I steal your billfold and then say, well, I accept my punishment, that doesn't justify my stealing in the first place. And if I give all kinds of reasons, for instance, that you are rich and that I'm poor and that I need the money and you don't, or things like that, it's still illegal.
Well, but the argument is a moral one, I think, here,
yes.
Not a legal one, because legally, clearly, violating the law cannot be justified. But one might argue that whereas breaking the law and then trying to escape is morally illegitimate, at least in the case of most laws, this is not the case.
It is certainly a different thing. You clearly, in the classical cases of civil disobedience, are not trying to do something that is an advantage to you. You're doing something as a matter of principle, etc.
Right.
So it's not quite the same. Nonetheless, I don't think it can be tolerated, frankly. Now, if you live in a country where you can generally say the law is unjust and I have no legal way to oppose it, then a lot of things can be said in favor of civil disobedience, even in favor of murder of a tyrant or things like that. But if you live in a country where you have legitimate and legal ways to express your opposition and to try to persuade others to change the law, then I think you're using illegal methods to change the law cannot be justified.
We were talking earlier about morality, and I wanted to ask you about what sort of basis do you think there may be to moral judgments? There are natural law advocates, there are divine law advocates, there are conventionalists, and there are those who think that the whole issue of morality is basically a fabrication, a moot thing.
Well, as for divine law, those who believe in religious dicta can accept it. But for the rest of us, divine law is not binding. What is binding for some is a substitute for divine law, natural law. The trouble with that is that nature doesn't tell us what to do. Nature makes some things possible and others not. Those that nature doesn't make possible, obviously we cannot do, so we don't have to worry. But among the possibilities that nature gives us, there's a wide range of choices. And I do not feel that nature tells us which of the possibilities to make into an actuality. Even such things that intuitively we object to, like such as murder or, for that matter, whatever you want, are not. I can't conceive of an unnatural act. If it is a possible act, nature makes it possible. Therefore, it cannot be unnatural. So what is meant here by unnatural is simply that nature makes it possible but objects. Well, I never heard the objection.
Well, the sense in which natural law theorists rely on nature is not in the sense in which, say, a physicist or a biologist talks about nature, but more in the sense in which someone who talks about the nature of something, the nature of an apple, the nature of a human being, the nature of an ox.
I can understand the logic of what you say, but I don't see any basis for it, because if I act against human nature, nature makes that possible. So then the objection to my action as unnatural is basically a moral objection. And that moral objection cannot be based on nature, because nature made the act to which one objects possible. Now, you say it's unusual, then that gives you a statistical basis, as it were, for what is naturally possible or likely. To say that something is against human nature obviously means either that it is impossible or disapproved. But for the disapproval, you have to have an objection other than merely to say, which would be circular, that it is against human nature.
So then when we talk about such horrendous crimes as murder deserving greater punishment than parking, we make moral assessments and we weigh things morally. Where do you find the source of these assessments, of these weighings, if not in natural law, if not in divine law?
It's not in natural law, and divine law is, the question arises, why must we obey it? And the answer that the religious person gives is because of the phrase that I have. It's a fine answer, but it doesn't work for people who... and it's not meant to work, really, for people who don't believe in religion. Let me point out, in fact, that religious people do find that divine law binds only the faithful. It does not bind others. Natural law, according to them, binds others. Even, in other words, a person who is not religious is bound by natural law in a moral sense. But they don't really tell me how I find out and why I must obey natural law. Now, if you ask why I feel that murder is a bad thing and should be punished, the answer is I feel it. I have the intuition to feel that. That is not a very satisfactory answer, but I haven't found a better one.
See, one problem is that you take upon yourself the authority to deal with someone who violates this intuition or feeling of yours, like a Jeffrey Dahmer or some, Ted Bundy. if they respond saying, well, we don't share your feelings, so don't bother us, why is that not a convincing response?
It's not necessarily convincing, but we, society, give the laws. And we give the laws following our feeling and to some extent usefulness and with respect to parking laws and other things. But the moral basis is not more than our feeling. If you say nature, you have to ask yourself, why do I have to obey nature when nature makes it possible for me to disobey? And if you say God, as I said, you have to believe in God. And even then, you still ask yourself why you obey him. So you might just as well say it's society and we obey it because we have decided to have these laws. Why do we decide to punish murder more than other things? Well, that's a long story, but in the end, it comes to our feeling.
So when you, for example, disagree or agree with, say, a political movement like libertarianism or egalitarianism, the basis for your disagreement is not some rationalistic view such as, say, Ayn Rand has in her objectivism or Leo Strauss has in his Neoplatonism, but more of a what kind of point of view? What do you put up against these people?
Well, I'm not a rationalist, and to the extent to which they are rationalists, I'm not a libertarian. By rationalist, I mean not that people are in favor of reason or use it, etc. Of course I am in favor of reason and using it. But a rationalist believes that the world is ordered or should be ordered according to rational principles. I am convinced that emotions play a much greater role in human life and should. And you can analyze rationally what people do, but you cannot assume that they are rational. And if you do assume it, and if you have rational ideas along those lines, you get into real trouble, such as, say, the communists did or so. Now, I'm not discussing the demerits of communism, but it was an attempt to rationally plan society, and as you know, it collapsed. I'm not opposed to some rational planning where it can be shown, but to just assume that you can rationally plan social action in general is a disastrous mistake, and that, I think, is a mistake that, for instance, libertarians make. They are in favor of minimizing social coercion, and so am I, but at least the more radical ones seem to go so far as to wish to eliminate it altogether. The same sort of thing as what I would answer to your second question, am I an egalitarian? If by an egalitarian you mean equality before the law, I'm in favor of that. Equality before the law means simply that the law should disregard anything that is not relevant to your particular case. If you're accused of murder, the fact that you're wealthy or poor, pretty or ugly, etc., should play no role. The thing that should play a role is the question that the jury is to answer is, did you do what you are charged with? Regardless of whether you're Catholic or whether you are a vegetarian or whatnot. So what we mean by equality before the law is that the law should disregard anything that is not within the law declared as relevant. But otherwise, we obviously are not equal. We are not born equal. The belief that many egalitarians have, that we are born equal and that only society and social arrangements make us unequal, I think is totally wrong. We are born unequal. Society should try to equalize our opportunities. It cannot fully equalize them. And there's nothing we can, again, if you are talented in any particular way, and I'm not. If you're a great athlete, then I'm not, and etc. That is not due to social circumstances. They play a role. But social circumstances are not what made Mozart a great composer and what makes someone else a great baseball player.
But you see, in the American political tradition, the notion of human equality is more restrictive, as it appears, for example, in the Declaration of Independence, when it says that all men are created equal.
I think they own their own lives. Therefore, I believe that they can end their lives when they feel so inclined. They don't have to be suffering or be diseased or so. I think people, if they're competent, should be free at any time.
Even past Dr. Kevorkian's
far
view?
Far past, yes, although I support him. Dr. Kevorkian is willing to help people end their lives if they suffer from a disease or pain or so. If you want to end your life and you don't suffer, and you are Tibor Makan, as competent as you are, I may try to dissuade you. But if that's what you want, if you decide life bores you and you just don't feel like going on with it, I may help you even if I'm convinced that you're competent and know what you're doing.
In this respect...
So I do think in this sense you own yourself.
And in this sense, everybody owns himself or herself.
Right, and everybody does, and nobody owns anyone else.
And that's an equality of sorts.
Well, of sorts, sure. In some respects, we are equal to each other. We all like to eat and do all kinds of things, and we all should have as much as possible opportunities for that. But I don't think I'm morally equal to Mother Teresa. I don't believe that you are morally equal to me. You might be better or worse. I don't think you should have the same chances, and I do not know any way in which we could arrange for that. So I'm not an egalitarian.
You are, however, often associated with the conservative movement in America.
Yes, I am.
You have had a long association, for example, with National Review and its publisher and editor, William F. Buckley.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that. How far does that go back? How did it begin, and where does it stand now?
It began, I met him, I was having lunch with Sidney Hook, and he passed by. And we got involved. He sent me the magazine, and I started to write for the magazine. He never changed anything I wrote, even though he certainly didn't agree with everything. Bill and I became friends. We used both to like cigars. We both have given up cigars. We used to like both opulent lunches. We haven't given those up altogether, but they're more rare. And most of the things in National Review I agree with, but I don't believe National Review does believe, for instance, it's strongly opposed to abortion.
Mm-hmm.
I'm more mildly opposed to abortion, and their reasoning is that they think that the embryo is a human being and therefore should not be killed for the same reasons for which we oppose the killing of any human being. I don't think the embryo starts as a human being. It's a potential human being in the same sense in which an egg is a potential chicken. But you can be a vegetarian and eat eggs. There is a difference between potential and actual. In the first, say, about 3 months of gestation, I think embryos are not full human beings. They are potential human beings. As their nervous system develops, as the brain develops, etc., they must be recognized as human beings.
To go further on in our public policy discussion, you know that the government as it stands today, there's a great many things that are at least objected to by libertarians, sometimes by conservatives. I want to hear a little bit about what you have to say about things like supporting the arts.
Let me make it very clear that I'm bitterly opposed to supporting the arts. Not because I don't like the arts, but I think the arts do much better when they're not being supported. or let me put it this way, both you and I would oppose censorship. One reason we would oppose censorship, there are many others, but one reason is that we don't feel that the government is a good judge of what is meritorious. If it were, then I would leave that to the government and we would get rid of a lot of bad art which the government could prohibit. But we don't let the government prohibit bad art because we don't think it can distinguish between good and bad art. Well, if that is true, then it cannot sufficiently distinguish between art that should be subsidized and art that should not be subsidized. And in fact, I think art flourishes much more when it is not subsidized. So I would be bitterly opposed. Tax exemptions, perhaps, in some mild support, yes, but not handing a tax money to arts or insisting that arts be used in building, etc.
I want to ask you about some other issues of widespread public interest, and that one of them is education. We have a lot of problems in primary, secondary, and even higher education in the United States, and I wanted to know what your assessment is. You've worked in this industry now for many, many years.
American education has failed, not so much in graduate school, but certainly in high school. Secondary education. I know very little about primary education. I think the major reason is simply this. American children are no less intelligent than children in other nations or capable of learning. What really is the trouble is that we don't ask them to learn anything. Say in Europe as well as in Japan, young people are regarded as, so to speak, apprentice adults. So they are made to learn a lot of things which will be useful, it is believed, later in their life. In America, we feel that being young is, as it were, not a means to learn things and so on, but an end in itself. We expect young people to enjoy their youth. There's nothing wrong with this. But also we expect them to do so at the expense of learning. So very little is asked from them. People come out of high schools not having learned the things that they should have learned. I know this because for years I have been teaching in college and graduate school, and really they know practically nothing. They're very nice people. And there are great things that they learn in high school, but they don't learn any of the things such as mathematics, say, or factual knowledge, etc., that they should learn. Now, it's true. Factual knowledge always changes. And basically what you should develop is the ability to learn. You can't learn everything that has to be learned in a limited time. But this ability to learn is only developed by actually teaching and making them learn some things, and we don't insist on that. So a change of attitude is needed, and that will be very hard to achieve. Meanwhile, some things, such as vouchers, promoted originally by my friend Milton Friedman, are very good. In other words, children and their parents should have the ability to choose their schools. They shouldn't be compelled to go to schools just because they're near or because some bureaucrat decides them to do that. Competition among schools would be good. The subsidy that children benefit from by going to school free of charge should be given not to the school but to them, the children or their parents, to be used wherever they see fit.
You don't have a fundamental objection toward public education as such, as some other people have.
Well, I don't have a fundamental objection, but I do think that private education has done much better than public education, and therefore we should seriously consider private schooling and financing private schooling.
What do you think of the underlying assumption in most of public education that young people required the same type of education, enter school at the same time, leave it at the same time, take the same courses, up until at least they get to college.
Let me put it this way. What is wrong is not that we require pretty much the same of every kid, etc., but rather that we require A, too little, and B, leave it to them, the kids and their parents, to decide what they should learn, and to a large extent even to the parents. In this sense, when you are very young, you do not know what it is that you ought to learn. If you did know that, you wouldn't need to go to school. But you do. So when you look at Japan or European schools, the curriculum is, in fact, considerably more rigid. We demand that they learn certain things. They are subjected to examinations. In this country, you graduate if you have a certain number of credits. In Europe and Japan and elsewhere, you graduate if you pass some examinations. In other words, the school doesn't ask how long did you sit in a class, but rather what you did learn, and that is tested by examinations. Now we are moving in that direction.
What do you think about the nature of the social sciences, this discipline, or the various disciplines of the social sciences, economics, political science, sociology, and so on? They seem to also encourage a kind of social engineering. Do you think that there is any foundation for this? What is your view of the social sciences in general?
Society cannot be studied in quite the same way as you can study in the natural sciences, because the students are part of it. They're not quite part of the insects, say, kingdom or so. And subjective and somewhat arbitrary notions are certainly involved. Nonetheless, there are some regularities in societies which are not different from natural law. I think it is true that, I don't know, if you reduce the price of something, people will buy more, all other things equal. If the price goes up, people will be able to buy less, again, all other things equal. And there are some other regularities which can be formulated. We haven't been able to go very far so far, I must say. Nobody, for instance, but while we are talking, America is going through a period of unprecedented prosperity. I don't know of any economist who has been able to explain it.
Yes. Is this just a lack of sufficient information, or do you think there is something about human nature itself that doesn't lend itself to those kinds of predictions?
No, I wouldn't say that. It's more complicated than it is in much of the natural sciences. But there are regularities in human behavior.
Do you think the concept of free will has any content?
But you see, there are regularities. If I ask you, for instance, now, to raise your right arm, you may do that. I don't think it's determined by law that all people raise their right arms when I ask them to. Some people don't. However, we can make statistical generalizations which would show that most people, when asked in a certain way, will do a certain action. I don't know what it means to say it's predetermined. If it means no more than to say that there are causes of action. For instance, my asking you is the cause of your raising your right arm, I think that's quite easily demonstrated. And we can, as I said, statistically, and all laws, either both in the natural sciences and in the social sciences, are basically statistical.
When we see, say, bad or destructive behavior on the part of other members of the animal world, we don't think of punishment, we don't think of blaming them, we don't think of declaring them wrong. But when we think of human behavior going badly, then these notions that suggest personal responsibility, causation by the agent rather than by other factors, come to play a role, or at least have been suggested to come to play a role. The social sciences seem to reject this.
I don't think the social sciences rejects this, so I think your premise is wrong. But you see, unless we have the notion of personal responsibility, whether that notion is justified or not, unless we make the assumption that we can hold people responsible for their behavior, there would be no criminal law and a lot of things. I mean, when I go out of this building, I don't expect to be killed, etc. Of course, there are cases where I might be killed, but on the whole, I can rely on other people not attacking me and so on. People are responsible for their behavior. That is our assumption. It's our assumption in criminal law. It's our assumption in education. It's our assumption in everyday life. In some cases, that responsibility is diminished by circumstances, etc., for instance, by taking drugs, but also by other kinds of circumstances. But without this assumption, I don't see how we could regulate, because there could be a moral basis for regulating social life at all.
But you recognize that there are many people in society who undermine and challenge that assumption.
Not really. I mean, in the social sciences, for instance, the assumption is personal responsibility and at the same time, predictability. But predictability does not mean predetermination. I simply predict what use you will make of your ability to choose. And I think that prediction can be successful. Now, it's not like in the natural sciences where you can isolate the thing you want to predict and either by observation or by setting up an experiment, decide how people will act. Social life is much more complicated.
You yourself are, in some sense, a social scientist. You have written in the field of sociology, and you're also involved in a psychoanalysis, which is often considered at least one of the social sciences. And I wanted to know, and as you deal with individuals in the therapeutic session, do you make the assumption that they are self-responsible, or do you think that all of the things that they do, believe, and so on, can be explained by various causes?
But you see, explained does not mean justified in the first place. But in the second place, if I have a patient, I treat him on the assumption that he will react in a certain way to what I do or say. I may be wrong. But unless I have the assumption of causality, there is no medicine, there is no psychology, no anything. So I do assume that there are certain actions, in the case of psychoanalysis, certain things I will say, that may elicit a certain reaction. That does not mean that he is not free or responsible. It means simply that I can predict, or hope I can predict, what he will do. And since I have certain aims which he shares with me, such as to be cured or rid of certain symptoms, I'll try to use my knowledge to his benefit.
How did you get into the field of psychoanalysis? I mean, it's not related that clearly to economics, so...
No, I have been interested in a lot of things not related to one another. I was analyzed myself, and my analyst thought I would make a good analyst myself. So for something like 25 years, I saw patients and helped some, was not able to help all, etc. Now, helping some involved helping them to understand themselves, and by understanding themselves, to be rid of acting in a way that was self-defeating in their own terms, which is what analysis generally tries to do.
Do you think that analysts have to have a certain knack, a kind of craft, that it is not enough to have a good theory to start with?
I think you're right. I think no one can be a good analyst unless he is reasonably intuitive and sensitive to what the patient is all about. So I think what you call a knack is quite necessary. More so, say, than in physical medicine, where it also is not absent, but there are tests you can do with machinery and blood chemistry, etc. We don't have that in psychoanalysis.
How do you test the success of a psychotherapeutic approach?
Well, this is probably quite controversial. We don't have animal experiments, or only very few. So we really are relying very much on our judgment and that of the patient himself. The patient may, and some observations we can make. The patient no longer does some things that he, when he came in, complained about. He says, I always do X. I don't really want to do X, but somehow I always do it. When he stops doing X, we may attribute this to our treatment to some extent. Of course, someone could say he would have stopped anyway. And it's very hard to distinguish the effects of the treatment from the effects, say, of the passage of time.
I wanted to ask you about one of your early books, The Jewish Mystique, in which you make observations about how both Gentiles and Jews look upon Jewishness in some skewed ways. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I don't know what you mean by skewed way. You know, I wrote this book because most of my friends were Jewish, and there is something interesting about Jews as a people. They have basically given the religious ideology to the world, which still is strong. They have persisted as a people, keeping their identity for centuries and centuries. So they have also provoked a great deal of what we call anti-Semitism, hostility to Jews. So I wrote a book trying to explain why there is anti-Semitism, why Jews have kept their identity, and so on. And so
why is there anti-Semitism?
Well, I have a
book on the subject, of course.
Well, yeah, I have a chapter. It's not that hard, you know. It's a small people who in antiquity insisted that their God was the only God, a notion that was quite new to antiquity, which had many gods and didn't mind worshipping a neighboring god or so, and felt that each of these gods had limited power and, so to speak, jurisdiction, as it was. The Jews believed that there was only one God and it was theirs, and that God had elected them, so to speak, for special treatment. Well, of course, this cannot but make people a little upset. Here's the whole Roman Empire with lots of gods and emperors who became gods and so on. And there was a Jew saying, no, we can't have any pictures of gods, any sculptures. They cannot be in where we live. And we have the only God. None of the other gods are real gods. They're just phonies. Naturally, that didn't lead to a great deal of popularity. And then, let me point out, they repeated this, so to speak. When Judaism became Christianity, the Jews insisted that this was not the real Messiah, Christ, that they had their own who was expected and came just for them. Naturally, that didn't make them very popular either, particularly since they, in effect, indirectly told the Christians that all the sacrifices they made, all the things they gave up for the sake of their God, were made in vain because their God was not really a God. The Jews had the only one, and so on. So it's quite understandable that there was a great deal of animosity to them.
How much of that had to do with the eventual catastrophic animosity of the 20th century
against
Jews? Yes.
It's very hard to say. Anti-Semitism has long, since at least the Roman Empire, been very strong in some places, less strong in others. It doesn't seem to me that there is a full explanation for the Holocaust, and I wouldn't dare giving one.
Well, you know, Karl Marx, in his essay on the Jewish question, equated the quintessential Jew with the quintessential capitalist.
Yeah.
Did that somehow contribute to this, maybe a form of resentment toward Jews?
Jews certainly were pioneers of capitalism for the very simple reason that they were not really allowed to participate in the preceding system, the feudal system, to which they were quite marginal. They invented a number of devices which were very helpful to capitalism. Sombart and others pointed that out. So the dislike or hatred of those who were attached to the feudal system was turned against Jews. I don't think that's a sufficient explanation, but it contributes to some extent.
What is your feeling about the propriety of promoting global capitalism into societies where maybe that is not immediately welcome?
Well, I think societies obviously are entitled to accept what you call the capitalist system, if that's what they want. And it can be demonstrated that they fare better materially if they do. It's the most efficient system known to man, and it works. But other societies may feel, and again, I would not oppose that, although they usually come not out as clearly as I am now, they may feel that it is worse not to have some efficiency, give up some efficiency, in favor of continuing their established cultural ways. There's no argument about it. It's what people want. The want is not expressed by a vote. It's expressed by their behavior. Some societies are reluctant to accept capitalism, as it were, and prefer to stick to pre-capitalist, sometimes feudal ways. It may not be the most efficient thing, but it seems to me, if that's what they want, we shouldn't impose our own way. If you go back, I mean, all the ex-colonies had other than capitalist ways. And I think they may not be that much better off having accepted the capitalist ways of their colonizers. The only one that did fairly well, having done so, is Japan. But all the others, see, in Africa or so, are probably worse off than they were.
Well, you know, from an individualist perspective, though, what you say is put too much in terms of what the society wants or what the culture wants. And that usually covers up the fact that a good many people within those cultures may not want that. And so you have a kind of sovereignty of groups, but reject the sovereignty of individuals, and that is just what's at issue.
But, you know, it's the individualism that you advocate is not the only system available. And some societies traditionally may have different ways of deciding social policy on non-individualist basis. That may be bad if you are an individualist, and not so bad if you're not.
See, this is the problem.
I don't think we should impose an individualist system on cultures that have not accepted it.
You talk about imposing such a system, but the individualist would say that they're imposing a system on their recalcitrant or dissident members, so the imposition starts with them, not with those who might want to rescue them from it.
It seems to me that what you're saying is that somehow a vote should be taken, and if they are more individualists than traditionalists, then individualism should prevail. That seems to me a peculiar rationalistic idea. Take, for instance, what happens now in the Balkans, or what happens in India, where the government just was dismissed and they have new elections. Well, the Indians, many of them, are religious fanatics. They believe in, some of their parties believe in strong nationalism, strong religious differences, etc. The same is true in the Balkans, where I think nationalism is very strong. And it's not just that the Serbs misbehave. The Croats, the Slovenes, the Bosnians, whatnot, all have their own national ideas, and all wish to prevail, and it's very difficult to keep the peace among them. I don't think you can come to these people and say, forget about nationalism, I mean, just live peacefully, have capitalism, prosper, etc. These people think in different ways, and I am not willing to say that these ways are less good than my own. Now, I don't wish to excuse some things that are rightly condemned universally, but on the whole, I don't think that we can impose a universal rationalist, individualist culture on people whose traditions oppose it. And it's not a matter that can be done by a vote.
Well, are there any standards of cross-cultural comparisons? Can you say that a culture is better than another on the basis of anything?
No.
Well, take an easier case. There are certain practices of certain cultures in Africa and India where there are drastic violations of human rights to which many Westerners, especially feminists, object. Are those cases something to which we can object?
I don't believe in human rights to begin with. I have no idea what that means. But if you mean to say it's a basic violation of our standards, it certainly is. So the next question is, do we have a right to impose, or should we impose our standards on them? If you were to say we want to make propaganda against them, I'd be for it. For outlawing them, I think it's probably too early to do that. Traditions have to be slowly modified. I certainly am against these things and many other national traditions, but I don't think that you can charge me with the opposite view, that national traditions should be disregarded altogether.
How does that relate to, for example, Americans' exportation of democratic institutions, for example, into Latin America? You've written on this subject.
Yes. And that exportation has not been very successful, but we can try. As long as we limit ourselves to propaganda and don't use compulsion, and as long as we allow their own traditions to, if not prevail, to continue, etc., I think it can be justified. If it's imposition, you cannot impose democracy and it doesn't work that way. It has to come from within.
I wanted to ask you something about American intellectual life. There appears to be a clear bias throughout academe in favor of left-wing values, values of collectivism, socialism, the welfare state, and so on, almost to the point where it's not really a matter of debate anymore. It's a matter of sheer exclusion of opposing views.
This is a very long dispute, starting with Plato, who wanted philosophers to be kings or kings to be philosophers, take it any way you want. Intellectuals have always felt that they are superior to non-intellectuals and they should run things. It has never worked that way. Intellectuals never have run things. They have advised people on running things, sometimes with good, sometimes bad results. But since Plato, they have felt that they should be in charge, and consequently, they have felt quite hostile to those who actually run things, which in our world is basically capitalists, if you wish, or so. They have felt that capitalism place them in an inferior or at least marginal position. As I pointed out, it's very well epitomized in La Bohème, Puccini's opera, which is based on Bürger's pictures from the life of Bohème, in which you find artists and other intellectuals or semi-intellectuals refusing to pay their rent, etc., because the landlord is a nasty person only interested in profit, whereas they, the intellectuals, are somehow superior beings. Now, if you look at the at literature since that time. You never find landlords or capitalists heroes. They're always villains, and the intellectuals always defeat them, and that is still the case today. You mentioned the liking of intellectuals for collectivism. It's just another way of saying they like to be in charge, because in collectivism, whether it's electoral or in any other fashion, people are not much in charge of their own fate. The government is. Intellectuals, until very recently, were almost uniformly leftist, and they still are to a very large extent.
Let me ask you, what are your current concerns? What do you think about? What would you like to write about? What are the things that occupy your mind today?
Well, I'm interested in criminology, so I'm going to write an essay on some aspects of criminology. And that's as far as I have gone. I may also want to write on egalitarianism. But again, I haven't done it yet, and I never know what I'll write until I have done it. So.
But you do write quite a lot still.
Yes, I'm interested in many things. I no longer write. I have to dictate because I don't see well enough. But I will intend to go on until I die. It's what I have always done. As I said before, I'm born an intellectual. I've never done anything other than concerning myself with ideas my own and those of others. And that's what I enjoy doing.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Van den Haag.
It was a pleasure.